Being Programmed to Chill, a show about business, crime, parapolitics, and esoterica, with your host, Jimmy Fallon Gong.
All right, so today we are joined by Comrade Chad, who is an artist, organizer, amateur historian, and fellow traveler. Now, I've been talking to Comrade Chad here for a while about these topics, and we found that we agreed and vibed on a mutual appreciation for some of the more obscure points that we're going to talk about tonight. So, Comrade Chad wrote an amazing outline for us to explore today, and I added a few sections, but by and large, I'm going to be mostly like maybe making sure that the average listener understands a few of the terms that we might be throwing around, but I'm very excited to have him on. How are you doing today, Comrade Chad?
Doing good. Happy to be here.
All right. So what are we here to talk about today, Chad?
We're here to talk about Leon Trotsky and his legacy in the communist movement.
A mixed bag.
Yeah, definitely a mixed bag.
A man of contrasts.
Celebrated by some, loathed by many.
Maybe we should just... So what's your personal experience with like Trotsky? Like, at what point were you even aware of his existence? And what were your highs and lows in terms of like your interest in Trotsky?
I think I was probably exposed to Trotsky in the same way that like most Marxists in the United States were. You know, he's sort of carried around as like a tragic figure in the history of the Russian Revolution, you know. Mm-hmm. this ideological purist, you know, who was like unjustly persecuted and assassinated by Joseph Stalin and his whole like wicked bureaucracy or whatever. He's carried up and upheld in the United States, I feel like, as like the rightful heir to the Soviet Union, and you know, who had his like kingdom usurped by this Georgian ruffian. So like it's kind of you're kind of conditioned from the jump to sort of like have sympathy for him, and then therefore like kind of view his movement and his whole interpretation of like Marxist science as sort of like the correct one, right? Like,
yeah, but you're right. Like, there's a like it's a good story, the Trotsky, you know, saga, because for some it's like almost like it allows an out for like the Leninist project that was betrayed, right?
Right. Yeah, it's a way, and especially after, which we'll see as we go into this discussion, like after the Cold War really gets into high gear, it's like, it's the ultimate refuge for communists who don't want to like be pro-Soviet Union, you know?
Yeah.
So yeah, he has this sort of like legacy, and he sort of represents like the blueprint for a certain type of Marxist personality, like in his own like personal wheelings and dealings within the Soviet Union and the CPSU. And he's kind of like the cliche of the guy that just cannot accept demsent when he loses a vote.
Now, for the listeners, what is demsent?
That would be democratic centralism, which is Lenin's sort of brainchild of like the synthesis between a robust democratic discussion and centralized sort of action led by a centralized body.
So basically you're saying Trotsky did not like to follow other people.
Nope. Yeah. If Trotsky wasn't the guy with the line that everybody was listening to, he was doing everything in his power to make sure that his line eventually became the one everyone was listening to. And like, this is a consistent sort of motivation for him throughout his whole career, like even before he was eventually expelled from the Soviet Union.
Yeah, and like, to be sure, the Russian Revolution is filled with colorful, strong personalities who don't like to follow necessarily. But so for sure, he wasn't exactly unique in that regard, but in some ways, he might be the best example of that.
I think he is definitely the best example. He's from my readings of him and some of the contextual evidence from like his contemporaries, he just seems like a really kind of like sneaky, duplicitous sort of like scheming kind of guy who always has an angle somehow and is always like looking for that sort of like edge, right? Like looking for some sort of like foot in the door to get his sort of way.
Always on the grind set.
Always on that grind set, yeah. And Trotsky himself, like after he died, like his movement sort of comes to embody something else, which is just kind of like left anti-communism, really. It kind of starts with Trotsky.
Yeah, that's right. And like, it's interesting, right? Because like Trotsky is certainly interesting enough to warrant talking about, but for sure, like we are going to be looking at some Trotskyist organizations in the future. But to really understand them, we really do have to understand Trotsky, right?
Yeah. And I think that's important to understand Trotsky too. And especially to sort of go back and sort of like check what his opposition, you know, i.e. like Stalin's Soviet Union, had basically concluded about this guy, right? Because if you take the Trotskyist point of view, like it's total sham, kangaroo court, show trials, all that, all the buzzwords, right? But there's actually like a lot of evidence, right, that after his expulsion from the Soviet Union, Trotsky was frustrated enough to consider collaborating with the preeminent fascist powers of the time, which is Nazi Germany and Imperial Japan, to create a fifth column within the USSR to overthrow Stalin's rule, like his leadership block, I guess. And the Lacerdo writes about this a lot in his History of Stalin. And I think he refers to it as like the third civil war, which is kind of interesting way to think about it.
You know, it's interesting you say that because a lot of Western historians like to paint Stalin as paranoid.
Yeah.
But as we're going to see, all of that paranoia about Trotsky just might have actually been valid.
Might have been a little warranted. I think I really like the way Lacerdo, I'm not sure if he's saying this or someone, he's quoting someone else, but he says that Stalin's problem might have been that he was too logical, right? so like, you know, it's like, oh, there's a lot of people like working for the Japanese, so let's just expel this entire like ethnic community just to be sure, like those kind of maneuvers. And maybe it was overkill, maybe it was not, but I think as we'll see going through talking about these sort of schemes, they make a lot more sense from Stalin's point of view
in the context. Yeah. We'll be right back. Let's just get into it then.
Cool. All right. So Leon Trotsky was born in 1879 in the Ukraine, and he was born to a wealthy Jewish family, and he had a kind of a little bit of a privileged upbringing. He was raised among the community of what they call Black Sea Germans, which are, you know, ethnic Germans that were living along some of the nicer areas in Ukraine. He entered political life as a Nardinik, which is like an agrarian populist, and he wasn't down with Marxism at first. It was his first wife, Alexandra Sokolovskaya, who finally convinced him to become a Marxist, and he entered. And it's unsure when exactly he became a member of the Russian Social Democratic Labor Party, or the RSDLP for short, but he identified as early as 1898. And he was originally exiled to Siberia for some of his Nardinik activities. And he went there with his first wife. And this is where he sort of like brushed up on the works of Marx and the works of Lenin. And I think eventually decided that he wanted to write for Iskra. And that was sort of like the beginning of his career with the RSDLP.
Yeah, Iskra, of course, being that famous newspaper that, correct me if I'm wrong, did Lenin, like, edit for it? Or maybe I'm not entirely sure, but it was like...
Yeah, they had a pretty big rotating circle of editors, and I think Lenin was one at one point. But he might have not been an editor when Trotsky joined as a writer.
Yeah. Also, I think that there were like different Iskras in different places. I could be wrong.
Yeah. Yeah.
Interesting.
Yeah. So he joins the party and immediately sort of gets to work, and he has like this really, I'm going to be real. Like, he has a pretty well-earned reputation as a pretty prolific writer. Mm-hmm. As well as a speaker and an organizer. In the sense that, like, Trotsky is sort of known for his logistical talents, right? He's really good at making sure projects get started and finished, usually through his own efforts. But again, I think all of that kind of stuff is sort of rooted in a very big ego, right? So almost immediately, he starts beefing with Lenin. Like, as early as 1903, Trotsky split with him over the issue of party organization. He wanted a more mass-oriented and open sort of party, like, which is what the Menshevik faction at the time also wanted. And he joined the Mensheviks briefly, but immediately he left and declared himself a non-factional social democrat. which Lenin and a lot of other old, some guys who would become later Bolsheviks sort of realized that it was a move so he could just promote his own agenda constantly. There's a pretty good quote that from Lenin in 1914, so like way later, after he's been dealing with this shit for a while, where he writes, Trotsky, however, possesses no ideological or political definitiveness. His patent for non-factionalism, as we shall soon see in greater detail, is merely a patent to flit freely to and fro from one group to another. Yeah, so right automatically right off the gate, kind of setting the precedent. I think his next big sort of accomplishment was he became the chair of the St. Petersburg Soviet, which is like a workers' council in St. Petersburg for the Bolsheviks, which is kind of like St. Petersburg at the time, along with Moscow, are like maybe one of three major industrialized centers in Russia at the time. So like the proletariat are there. And by all accounts, again, Trotsky proves to be a pretty good, you know, organizer in terms of like speaking, writing, and kind of like rallying people to action. But in 1905, after he gets placed in charge of the St. Petersburg Soviet, he immediately shitposts something against the Tsarist government, and they like crushed the Soviet like a week later. Like he put out a statement in November, and then in December the Tsarist secret police and the gendarmes like just completely annihilated the Soviet, and in 1906 Trotsky had to go into exile again, and this time he went to Vienna, which is where he spent quite a lot of time, like almost 3 years, maybe even longer. And he met a lot of his friends that he would become that would actually become a little bit involved in some of his conspiracies later in life, particularly Christian Ravakovsky, who was like a Bulgarian communist, I think. So when Trotsky was like covering the Balkan Wars in like early 1910, 1911, that's when he met him, as well as Adolf Joff, who famously was the guy who introduced Trotsky to the concept of psychoanalysis, which just kind of rang out to me a little bit as a note to consider, because as we'll see, Trotsky was very good at telling people what they wanted to hear, and then sort of getting them to do what he wanted, but through that approach.
Now, this time in Vienna, I'm trying to recall if Lenin was there, because I know that Lenin was in Vienna around the same time, I think.
I'm not 100% sure of. You're right. It's either Vienna, or I feel like Lenin might have been in London, because that's where they had the I think it was the fifth Congress for the RSDLP, and Trotsky went to London to meet there. So I think that's where Lenin was based, but
yeah,
not positive. So another little thing, little anecdote, I guess, from his time in Vienna that sort of like paints a picture of how petty Trotsky could be, is also a pretty funny story. He asked to become an editor of Pravda, which was another magazine, literary magazine of the RSDLP at the time. It was a Bolshevik-controlled central committee that controlled it, the party at the time. So they agreed to finance Pravda through the year, but only if another Bolshevik would be added to the editorial board with Trotsky. He selected his brother-in-law, a name that we'll also probably, you know, be hearing a lot more of, Lev Kamenev, to this board. In 1910 and through 1912, he, you know, is basically using this paper as his own kind of like platform. A lot of polemics are going out, a lot of analysis, article after article. Trotsky it never misses an opportunity to add his two cents in to whatever thing is being discussed. I think it was Rosa Luxemburg who like wrote a piece just titled "Trotsky Doth Protest Too Much." So, like, again, this is just the kind of guy that he is, right? So the paper folds in 1912. The Bolsheviks, I think, controlling the Central Committee at the time, kind of withdrew funding as things were sort of shaping up in Russia on the eve of World War I. So later in that same year, after the paper folded, the Bolsheviks in St. Petersburg started distributing their own magazines, also called Pravda, which apparently infuriated Trotsky so bad that he wrote a letter to his friend, I'm going to butcher this name, Nikolai Chikhedze, denouncing Lenin so badly that the Tsarist secret police who intercepted the letter kept it and you was like, we can use this to create a schism in the party, you know, because it was that like incendiary. And
do you recall what kind of things he was saying?
No, I probably should have read the letter, but I don't remember. But he was mostly furious about the fact that like he accused the Bolsheviks of stealing his paper and like stealing his ideas and basically deplatforming him. Like that's what he was pissed about. Like in the same way that like a YouTube guy like flips out when they lose their channel or some shit. Like that's what Trotsky was mad about.
Yeah.
In this instance, and the letter survived even like after the revolution in October, and was again used as evidence against Trotsky in like the early 20s when the whole like struggle for leadership in the party was emerging after Lenin died.
Let that be a lesson to our listeners about deleting old tweets.
yeah, clean. If you're gonna take a new post, man, make sure you go back and look at the stuff you were writing back in the day. Make sure you can't get any kind of trouble. So 1912 also was a year when Lenin and the Bolsheviks and a few dissenting members of the Mensheviks formed the Communist Party of Russia. They split from the Russian Social Democratic Labor Party. Trotsky was not part of this decision, and he really like desperately wanted to stop it. So one of the things that he did was organized the remaining elements of the RSDLP into something called the August Bloc, and he used that to try to keep the Bolsheviks from splitting, he failed. So he had this. He's sort of on the out when World War I breaks out. And because of World War I, he had to leave Vienna in 1914 and flee to Switzerland, where he joins the Swiss Communist Party and starts to organize and advocate for an anti-war position among European socialists from Switzerland. Then he bounced around to France and then got deported to Spain in 1916. Spain didn't want him, so he got deported from the United States, and that's where he settled in the Bronx.
So it is important, I think, to talk about Trotsky's activities before the Russian Revolution of 1917, because I think it reveals a lot about Trotsky, right? So, like you said, Trotsky was in France in 1916, where he was spreading anti-war and anti-Tsarist propaganda. Like you said, he was deported to Spain in the fall of 1916. Interestingly, like you said, because Spain didn't want him, someone gave him cash and first-class tickets to New York City. A mysterious benefactor, perhaps. Mm. Professor Richard B. Spence, whose work I am drawing on heavily for these sections, suggests that this mysterious benefactor could have been a couple people. One could have been Trotsky's mentor and co-conspirator, Alexander Helphand, aka Parvus. And by the way, it's interesting, right? Because Trotsky, one of the main things he's known for is the concept of permanent revolution.
Yes.
Which, like we were talking, Chad, like it technically goes back to the writings of Marx.
Yeah.
But in the more modern context, Parvus probably formulated most of it. And then Trotsky would be known for it to the point where people often credit it to him, right?
Yeah, interesting.
But the interesting thing about Parvus is that he was both a revolutionary and a businessman, which is not Well, it's interesting, right? Because we typically view those as like literally opposites. But there were actually a ton of like early Bolsheviks and like just revolutionaries that actually did seem to have like a good like businessman's instincts, I guess. And Parvis had a killer business instinct, in fact, because he set up an arms trading company. Yeah, right. Not where you were thinking if this was going.
No, it wasn't.
So Parvis's arms company was in Copenhagen, and he got up to all kinds of things. Like, he funneled tons of weapons to the Young Turks as they were, you know, basically starting Turkey, you know, the modern day state rather than the Ottomans,
right,
and so forth. Also, Parvis dealt with both the Krupp company and Vickers. Lord knows my listeners know I'm terribly interested in Krupp arms and Krupp steel. And Vickers, of course, was the British competitor to Krupp. So essentially, Parvis is in bed with German and British like heavy industry, right? The arms trade specifically. And Parvis worked a ton with a certain infamous arms dealer named Basil Zaharov, who I talked about in my episode 20 of my Krupp series, who is just like the like probably one of like two or three of the most famous arms dealers of the early 20th century.
Yeah, notorious bad guy.
Right?
Yeah.
So Parvis had a relationship with Vickers and Zaharov, which meant that he was working hand in hand with British intelligence. With Krupp, of course, he had interactions with German intelligence. Now, it has long been speculated that Parvis would do business and tithe portions to the revolutionary movement. And it would be a thing that would be leveraged against Lenin, that he was getting money from Parvis. And this is a complicated thing because it's naturally very shadowy. It was certainly in the context of like wartime propaganda that these allegations were being broadcast, but it maybe was true. Like, and it's also complicated by the fact that both Lenin and Rosa Luxemburg denounced Parvis. But it's like, did they have to? Was that like part of the plan? You know, this is almost like really weird territory. Like, what is this, like the FARC in Colombia or something? Like,
yeah, it's interesting. I have never heard of this character, and I somehow missed him in my own research. So this is like, I feel like this is filling in a gap that, yeah, go on.
Yeah, yeah. And so like Parvis basically like was way closer to Trotsky than he was with like any, like then certainly with like, you know, Lenin, Luxembourg, take your pick for like other people at the time. Mm-hmm. And Trotsky would like talk, like there's a whole chapter in his huge book, The History of the Russian Revolution, where he talks about the slander that Lenin was a German agent. So he pretty much denies it. But like Trotsky was closer to this guy than Lenin was, you know?
Yeah, that's crazy. I mean, like Trotsky himself, again, like comes from a sort of like upper crust Ukrainian family. And I remember when we were talking, you dropped some knowledge on me about his, what was his uncle or his great uncle?
Oh, dear Lord. You made many, many poor people. I realize, of course, it's no shame to be poor. But it's no great honor either. So what would have been so terrible if I had a small fortune? If I were a rich man, yabba-dibba-dibba-dibba-dibba-dibba-dibba-dibba-dum, all day long I bidda-bidda-bum. If I were a wealthy man, I wouldn't have to work hard, yabba-dibba-dibba-dibba-dibba-dibba-dibba-dum. If I were a bidda-bidda-rich, idle-diddle-diddle-diddle man, I'd build a
big tall house with the rooms by the dozen, right in the middle of the town. A fine tin roof with the real wooden floors below. There would be one long staircase just going up, and one even longer coming down, and one more leading nowhere just for show. I'd fill my yard with the chicks and turkeys and geese and ducks for the town to see and hear, squawking just as noisily as they can. And each lobster game will land like a trumpet on the ear, as if to say, here lives a wealthy man. If I were a rich man, yabba-dibba-dibba-dibba-dibba-dibba-dibba-dibba-dum, all day long I biddy-biddy-bum. If I were a wealthy man, I wouldn't have to work hard, yabba-dibba-dibba-dibba-dibba-dibba-dibba-dum. If I were a biddy-biddy rich, idle-diddle-diddle-diddle-man, I see my wife, my golden, looking like a rich man's wife with a proper double chin, supervising meals to her heart's delight. I see her putting on airs and strutting like a peacock. Oh, what a happy mood she's in, screaming at the servants day and night. The most important man in town will come to phone on me. They will ask me to advise them, like a Solomon the wise. If you please, Rebetavia, pardon me, Rebetavia, posing problems that would cross a rabbi's eyes. And it won't make one bit of difference if I answer right or wrong. When you're rich, they think you really know. If I were rich, I'd have the time that I like to sit in the synagogue and pray, and maybe have a seat by the eastern wall, and I discuss the holy books with the learned men 7 hours every day, and that would be the sweetest thing of all. If I were a rich man, yabba-dibba-dibba-dibba-dibba-dibba-dibba-dum, all day long I biddy-biddy-bum. If I were a wealthy man, I wouldn't have to work hard, yabba-dibba-dibba-dibba-dibba-dibba-dibba-dum. Lord, who made the lion and the lamb, you decreed I should be what I am. Would it spoil some vast eternal plan? If I were a wealthy man.
So to understand Trotsky, we have to talk about Uncle Abram. So Uncle Abram was Trotsky's uncle, but he was 11 years older than Trotsky, so it was closer to like an older brother type of relationship. And they were in fact quite close. What's more, Uncle Abram Zhivatovsky was a millionaire. Please don't start shouting at me about angles or something before you hear the entire story. Yes, class traders exist, No, I am not angry at people for being rich. I think you need to hear about Uncle Zhivatovsky first, okay? So Zhivatovsky and his brothers were members of the successful German Jewish business community in Tsarist Russia. Like you were saying, they were, you know, in that Ukrainian region, but their business interests, you know, eventually were all over the Russian Empire. So they started with a sawmill, but they got into like sugar refining. They got into contracting. They got into stock speculation and banking. By 1914, both Uncle Abram Zhivatovsky and at least two of his brothers were millionaires. Now, we know that Zhivatovsky joined the Moscow Merchants Club in 1897. Then he left for Eastern Russia. It's not clear what he was doing the entire time, but he would show up in Vladivostok, which, of course, is a hotbed of espionage and business. And wouldn't you know, in Vladivostok, Zhivatovsky had a certain employee named Sidney Reilly, also known as the Ace of Spies. He is a super interesting and super, like, it would be more than its own episode just to talk about Sidney Reilly, but know that he is one of the most famous spies, basically.
Damn.
So it's not clear exactly what Zhivatovsky was doing during the 1905 revolution, but by 1908, he was also a lumber merchant. By 1912, he was director of the Tula Cartridge Works, which was one of the main suppliers of ammunition to the Russian army. So between that and Parvis having an arms company, like, we are like very tied in with both intelligence and the arms trade, basically.
Yeah. two relationships that Trotsky would arguably maintain for the rest of his life, I would say.
That's right. So you see, it's not just like, oh, he has a rich uncle that just, I don't know, has like a factory or something. This is like a keyed in guy.
Yeah, and especially when we get to some of his activities like post-exile, right? Mm-hmm. This provides a lot of useful context for just explaining how the fuck Leon Trotsky had all of these like duplicitous connections, right?
Yeah, sometimes like when you would hear like, without context, all of the accusations leveled against Trotsky, they sound absurd when it's like, nobody is that like connected, but like this guy actually was like,
yeah, he was extremely connected.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So Zhivatovsky, he then got into, or got very tied in with the Russo-Asiatic Bank, which was the largest financial institution in the Russian Empire. This bank was run by Alexis Pudilov, who was Zhivatovsky's friend and business partner. Get this, Zhivatovsky, Trotsky's uncle, was a personal friend and like acquaintance, interacted, did business with Prime Minister Stolypin. Right?
Yeah. Damn, I didn't know any of that. That's crazy.
And not just that, he also knew like the Grand Duke Mikhailovich. He also knew the clique of Freemasons surrounding Prince Bebutov. Yeah, that's a whole thing. Did I mention Uncle Abram Zhivatovsky was also a Freemason? No, I'm not saying that purely just to like it, but like it is in fact relevant to the Bolsheviks. The whole Freemason angle is like, it doesn't explain everything at all, but like it was a factor in the events of the Russian Revolution.
Yeah. And certainly, again, also speaks to the sort of like circles that these guys were running in.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So the Russian secret police, the Okhrana, they regarded that Bebutov guy, the prince that Zhivatovsky was friends with, as a security risk. Right. So like Uncle Abram was friends with not just, you know, his nephew Trotsky, but like this other faction of like basically elites that were regarded as like a risk as well.
Right. With that, so that's like some of the smaller aristocracy in Russia, which were also, you know, sort of in crisis at that time, and had their own like beefs with the Tsar.
That's right.
Yeah.
So it gets better somehow, okay?
Oh, man. All right.
So when World War I broke out, Zhivatovsky formed a syndicate overseas to do purchasing for the Tsarist regime. Longtime listeners of my show know my maxim that purchasing is frequently both cover for and itself doing espionage work. So Zhivatovsky set up offices for purchasing in New York, London, Stockholm, and Tokyo. The Okhrana monitored these businesses, but it does not appear that they, like, it doesn't appear that they were working directly for the Okhrana, or that the Okhrana was even really, like, cut in on this. So this is, like, not Russian intelligence necessarily. And they did not trust Zhivatovsky. So to that end, they actually started an investigation into his businesses in March of 1915. The reason they did that was because they thought that Zhivatovsky was selling grain, Russian grain, to Germany, which was probably true, which would be illegal under, you know, the conditions of World War I. Mm-hmm. So as they were poking around and researching and investigating, the Okhrana were startled by what they found, because instead of some relatively simple operation where it's like, okay, maybe a shell company, boom, there's the grain, you know, grain for cash, something like that. No, instead they found a complex commodities operation that laundered money through a complicated network of foreign banks and shell companies. So Professor Spence argues that Zhivatovsky was doing what Parvis was doing, making money moves, doing business, and then diverting some of the profits to support revolutionary subversion. So the Okhrana were really good at certain things, but they were not forensic accountants, so they didn't get very far in this investigation. So in May of 1915, Russian army counterintelligence took over the investigation, which led to Zhivatovsky's arrest and imprisonment. He would be released in January 1916, and the release is not at all clear why he was released, because different people would attribute it to bribes or lack of evidence or political cover. It is not clear what got him cleared, but Zhivatovsky went right back to his import-export business, and from that point on, he would work more closely with the Russian Commercial and Industrial Bank. And he just continued doing stock and currency speculations. So by 1917, when Trotsky reached out to him again, Uncle Abram had high-level ties to the Russian ruling class and international finance. So, it's not at all clear that Uncle Abram had any revolutionary sentiments, like, or it, I should say, it's not clear that he was like a communist as Trotsky, you know, was. Mm-hmm. But it is hard to believe, like, it's hard to believe that he would be like a crypto Marxist hanging out with like the prime minister Stolypin or something. Mm-hmm. But then again, he was, of course, friends with these more revolutionary princes. So like, maybe he was hoping for like more of a Napoleonic revolution type of thing.
Yeah, I think that's probably a safe bet. Also, I mean, like, a lot of Western European powers were really not excited about the idea of industrialized, fully modernized Russia either. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we're often looking for some sort of angle to get in there and undermine Russian power. The British were very big on this. And then so were the Polish, and to a lesser extent, the Japanese.
Oh yeah. So there was a lot of people who could have been playing a lot of games. Like,
yeah,
there's a veritable, like, just sea of different groups of people, like, trying to do different things. And like, there's no one faction, right? Like, everyone is working an angle on someone else, basically.
Yeah, and this again is a sort of a reoccurring theme, right? Because a lot of people will, when we get to the later parts, will probably be like, well, why would an avowed communist like Leon Trotsky, like, be willing to work with Hitler's Germany or Imperial Japan, you know? And yeah, just different angles, cross purposes, for enemy, a lot of enemy of my enemy is my friend stuff going on.
Exactly. And it's like, you can certainly have your ideology, but like, no one in this entire story before, during, or after the revolution was like against doing business if it advanced their own interests. Right.
Yeah. Do you know if Uncle Abram was cutting his nephew checks, like when he was like pre exile, like before his exile to Vienna?
So I believe, like, I think that Professor Spence believes that it is all but certain, but I don't think, like, I think the way it would have worked would have been like, it would have mostly been cash. Like, most people don't, you know, cut checks to their revolutionary nephew, right?
Right, right.
There would become more, somewhat more clear evidence of Uncle Abram supporting him, like, a little bit later in the story.
It makes me think of anecdote where, it, like, I think it was in like 1905, the Mensheviks were in control of the RSDLP, and they, along with Trotsky, sort of passed this ban on what they called expropriations, which was essentially like Stalin and his gang robbing banks to fund the party. And Trotsky got on Stalin's ass again, like, after that decision was made, because, you know, he was still doing it. And I guess you would have a problem with that if, you know, you had other means of income.
Yeah. Right. Cause it's like, certainly cutting down on his power as the guy with the connections for the funding. And I mean, I'm not going to be that guy, but it's like, is robbing a bank technically more honest maybe than selling arms and then diverting the cash? I don't know. It's an open question, right?
Yeah, it's a good ethical pondering right there.
Yeah. So it's not just Uncle Abram, right? It like I said, there were also other uncles. It's just Abram was closest with Trotsky. But also, get this. In 1918, the U.S. Bureau of Investigation opened an investigation on Trotsky's other uncle, David Zhivatovsky, who was a Russian banker. And he shows up in the United States in order to, well, his stated reason is that he's there to pursue a lawsuit in the courts, you know, doing international deals or whatever. But the investigation found that this guy had a bank account with National City Bank worth $150,000. So in today's money, that would be almost $3 million. And they're just like, he's never been in the country before. When would he have set up this bank account? What, like, what is the money for? Where did it come from? Like, sure, like, he's a banker, but like, you know, what's going on here?
Dang.
And because they couldn't answer any of those questions, they denied his visa, partially because they were afraid he might be a front for Leon Trotsky and or the revolutionary movement.
Interesting. Yeah.
Which was almost certainly true.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, that seemed to be an anxiety of a lot of the, like, governments wherever, like, Trotsky would bounce around to in his periods of exile. Like, they were always worried about him coming in and just, like, stirring up shit, basically. That's why the Spanish didn't want him. That's why the French could only tolerate him for so little. He seemed to not get a lot of resistance when he was in the United States. But, of course, he also didn't stay in the United States very long.
Yeah. No, exactly. And it's like, on the one hand, it's like, they're not kicking him out just because he gives a good speech. Because, like, by all accounts, he gave a great speech. But, like,
right.
It's also like, okay, like, yes, some really freaking strong ties to a lot of, and he had a lot of resources. Like, I'm not saying that it was right, but, like, it makes sense why they would be booting him out.
Yeah, yeah. He was definitely connected, and definitely, I mean, yeah, the details you just described about his uncle and, like, those are a lot of influential type people, right? That can get a lot of favors, because you know they're not going to be asking like the heads of state. They're going to be asking like, you know, the local like immigration office guy, or you know, whoever, like whatever friendly diplomat is in the region to like just, you know, curry a little favor and like move things around.
Exactly. And I do want to say as a side note, like, I don't think that like this diminishes Trotsky's revolutionary activities. Like, up to a certain point, like, I'm on board with a lot of this, right? Like, in the service of something good, you know, some of this sounds pretty cool to me, right?
Yeah. Like I, you know, I share a bunch of little anecdotes about like, you know, Trotsky being kind of petulant and petty about stuff, but for all intents and purposes, this guy was on the grind. Like he was nonstop writing, you know, always giving speeches. Very much seems like really more comfortable like behind a desk or like on a podium than, you know, maybe some of the like on the ground, like among the workers type organizing. But he still even had a knack for that. There were like plenty of accounts of when he would show up to the St. Petersburg Soviet and like would just enthrall people with like hours long speeches, and would really like kind of galvanize these Russian workers to action a lot.
Exactly. And then one final interesting Trotsky extended family note, Sidney Riley, the aforementioned ace of spies, actually married one of Trotsky's cousins.
No way.
So we'll keep that in mind for a little bit later.
Yeah. All right, so Trotsky's in the Bronx. He's still writing. He's very much paying attention to what's going on in Russia and the courts of World War I.
So, as we've established, right, Parvis or maybe Uncle Abram gave Trotsky first-class tickets and $500 in funds to go to New York City in 1917. And for the listeners out there, do keep track of the money that I'm mentioning, because the numbers don't add up. Okay. So he arrives in New York with $500. Maybe like, you know, from one of those connections, right? And then where does Leon Trotsky go when he arrives in New York City? Now, if you were to read Jacobin, Verso Press, several of the books about Trotsky's time in New York City, everybody says the Bronx, which is true, but he didn't go to the Bronx first. The first place he went to was the Hotel Astor.
Huh.
The Hotel Astor, one of the most expensive hotels in the city.
Yeah. Named for essentially American royalty.
A frequent spot of Wall Street's financial and banking elites, right?
Damn.
Now, that's weird. Why would he go to the most expensive hotel in New York City rather than, say, the Bronx, which would make sense?
Maybe he was meeting a friend.
Maybe he was meeting a friend. Exactly. So there's two ways of looking at it. Either he didn't know and someone made the reservation for him, which is the way... There's a book out by Verso Press, and that's how they sort of spin it. Or on the flip side, I don't know, maybe Trotsky picked it himself. Like, I don't know. Either way, I think it's telling. But so Trotsky, it's not clear. I think he only stays in the Astor for like a week or something. And then he moves to a 3-bedroom apartment in the Bronx. Now, notably, I don't know exactly how much the Astor Hotel would have cost, but probably a lot. The Bronx apartment, we do know, because it would have been, I want to say, $20 a month, right? So the apartment came unfurnished. We actually know all these details. So Trotsky bought $200 worth of furniture on credit, which would be roughly $5,000 of furniture today.
Bang.
I know. This required a co-signer, and by all accounts, we know who the co-signer was. It was this Polish-Jewish-American author named Sholem Asch, who, you know, he has a whole body of work, but he actually said, and I don't know if this is supposed to be a joke or not, but he said that Trotsky stiffed him with the bill for the furniture, which is funny.
Classic.
being a revolutionary man. Sounds fun. So after the October Revolution and Trotsky became world famous, the New York City Deputy Attorney General named Alfred Becker, he was like, you know how attorney generals are. They always want to do a little grandstanding. So they're like, wait a minute, this guy was just in New York City. What was he doing? So he puts on this whole sort of like show investigation to figure out, you know, what was Trotsky doing in New York City? And that's where a lot of these details come from. But this investigation found that Trotsky was writing and editing for a Russian socialist newspaper in New York City, for which he was getting paid $20 a week. I think he was there, what was it, maybe like, it was like under 3 months, I think, something like that.
Well, yeah, so he left New York in March 1917, and he arrived in September 1916.
Yeah.
So that's like 4 or 5 months.
Yeah. So people this investigation added up that Trotsky could have officially only made something between $700 to $1,000 during his time in the United States, officially anyway. That counts giving speeches, editing, maybe getting some like normal donations.
Mm-hmm.
Now, this is important, right? Because he arrives in New York with $500. He earns, to be generous, maybe $1,000. And he still has to pay for furniture, pay for food, pay for lodging, right? And then he has to buy tickets on the Norwegian steamship that takes him back to Europe, right? Mm-hmm. And then he gets arrested, and he has precisely $1,394.50 on him. So the math does not add up.
No. It's there's some fuzzy numbers right there.
But like, of course, he's a committed lifelong revolutionary. So like, of course, he has hidden sources of income and funding, right? Mm-hmm. But this is pre-revolution, so there's no state backing. So, well, wink. So where is the money coming from? And even taking all that into account, which is like interesting, and I can't help but run the numbers, but like the money he literally had on him, small potatoes compared to the game that he was probably playing, which is to say, he was probably securing major funding for the revolutionary movement. Now, I know this sounds crazy, and a lot of Marxists would probably not even like this line of reasoning, because the narrative is that like the Bolsheviks triumphed through like not German funding and
British
and American funding, which is like, you know, on the principles of Marxism, Leninism. And like, I don't think it denies anything to say that they were getting assistance from the enemies of Russia, right?
Oh yeah, I would totally agree.
Mm-hmm. So Professor Spence argues that, well, he says there is no hard evidence that Jacob Schiff, the Warburg family, Kuhn, Loeb and company, the JP Morgan, there is no hard evidence that any of them gave Trotsky funds. But there is strong circumstantial evidence to suggest that. And yes, I am also aware that this sounds perilously close to certain anti-Semitic conspiracy theories about Jewish control of finance and or the revolutionary movement. However, and I do want to be clear about this, I do not think that's what the historical record shows. But I do not think that it's in anyone's interest to not talk about this stuff either, right?
Yeah, yeah.
So Wall Street investment banks, there were largely two camps, the camps represented by JP Morgan and a investment bank known as Kuhn, Loeb & Company. And this roughly divides into like Anglo-American and Jewish-American with ties to German spheres of finance. Now, Trotsky would meet with agents from both banks, and both would have legitimate reasons to back Trotsky, at least to like provide some funding, because Morgan, more closely tied with British finance, Kuhn, Loeb and Company more tied to German, both of them would have a reason to like try to stick the knife into the Russian Empire.
Yes.
So, and forgive me, Chad, there's just a little bit more.
No, this is all good shit, man, by all means.
Okay, cool. So Jacob Schiff, one of the guys, he was a banker that worked for Kuhn, Loeb and Company. He built it, arguably, into the second largest investment bank in the U.S. He was largely doing that through financing the railroads. So that was like his, you know, bread and butter. Then after Schiff secured the bag and became vastly wealthy, he became a preeminent philanthropist. And he, you know, he was well known in the later part of his life as a philanthropist, but he was very sympathetic to both the plight of Russian Jews, and he was heavily invested emotionally and fiscally in Kaiserreich Germany. Like I said, that would be a legitimate reason for funding Trotsky's efforts to do a revolution in Russia, which could potentially cause a separate peace or undermine Russia's war efforts.
Yeah.
So a guy named Charles Crane, who is a U.S. businessman, would state to the State Department that Jacob Schiff gave Leon Trotsky $50,000, which would be roughly $1 million today, which is like, no, we can't necessarily like take that as the God's truth, but it's not nothing either.
Right.
So similarly, U.S. military intelligence identified Felix Warburg, the Warburgs being another contingent of the Kuhn, Loeb and Company. And the Warburg family, of course, is like pretty big in banking in multiple countries. So they identified Felix Warburg, who was in, I think it was the German banking, as one of a group of Germans financing Russian revolutionary activities. And a report from 1917 by a British agent in Russia identified Max Warburg as the chief German agent in Russia. And then possibly, in my mind, the most telling of all, J.P. Morgan, who, of course, is decidedly not Jewish. J.P. Morgan was more closely aligned to British finance, British geopolitical interests, the whole Anglo-American establishment thing, right? So J.P. Morgan practiced a thing known as Morganization, which was a practice, wouldn't you know, it came back in like the 80s, right? But like, basically, the concept is a targeted company is looked at to be acquired, and the way, and basically through multiple means, they would attack the company, drive down its stock price, basically like an aggressive takeover, right? Then once the company is on the ropes, Morgan would scoop up the stock at a lowered price. Then they would do a draconian restructuring. Then the company would be integrated into the broader cartel. Now, Professor Spence argues that what could be done to a company could, with a little imagination and a lot of money, be done to a country. And it's notable that Morgan would do these Morganizations with his own private intelligence service. So beyond maybe just like, we'll return to that idea in a little bit, but it's an interesting thing to think about. So almost done here. In Trotsky's MI5 dossier, there is a report, or there's reference to a SIS report entitled Russian Revolutionaries in New York, Activities and Movements of Trotsky Leon. And this report is referenced, but it's missing. It does not appear in his MI5 dossier. Mm. Interesting, right?
Also a recurring pattern with Trotsky.
A recurring pattern with Trotsky that certain documents just go missing.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
So let me paint you a scenario. Unaccountable bankers, both Gentile and Jewish alike, financing a group which later turns out to be the enemies of the country and for whatever reason at the time seemed like a good idea to back. Yeah, that is definitely not something that has ever happened before or since in banking history, right?
Yeah, no, totally unusual.
Not like with the Nazi party itself, with British banking, not like, Lord knows, the United States has done it half a dozen, probably several dozen times. So to make this more clear, and to conclude my section, in the United States, there were banking factions aligned with both either the United Kingdom, which was the Morgan faction, or Germany, which would be the Warburg, Schiff, Kuhn, Loeb, and Company faction, both of which would have legitimate reasons to back a revolutionary group which would undermine the Russian war efforts. We're talking realpolitik, not some evil Judeo-Bolshevik conspiracy, right? So that's my two cents.
Damn. Yeah, that I think that provides a lot of necessary context on the material side from my outline. So, and I mean, you know how much we MLs love our materialist analysis. So
it's kind of our thing.
Yeah. Big, definitely a good contribution. All right.
Thank you. Shit.
February Revolution kicks off in 1917. This is the one that deposes the Tsar, mm-hmm. for the most part, and then also leads to, I think, the creation. Oh, wait, was the Duma after 1905 or was it after the February Revolution?
I think the Duma came after 1905.
Yeah, I think
in right. response. But I mean, yeah, like after the Tsar, then there was like, yeah, there was like a change. Yeah.
It was a provisional government, which was, I guess, was just like the Duma II. Like it was just expanded
with Kerensky, right?
Yeah. And, Grigory Livov, who was like, I think he was a prince, one of the, so Trotsky hears this news and is immediately like, you know, I got to get back into this action. So he boards the SS Christiana Fjord, the Norwegian ship that you were mentioning. And then on his way there, he gets picked up by British naval intelligence. Yeah, so, you know, another fateful, you know, meeting, I guess, for Leon Trotsky.
You got to wonder, what were they talking about?
They certainly had some stuff to talk about, because Trotsky spent some time in the Amherst prison camp in Nova Scotia. So he, while he was there, he, as you know, you could imagine, got the reputation of being sort of a rabble-rouser. He was leading speeches to the inmates and sort of like organizing, I guess you say, like struggle sessions, basically like going over Marxist lit, like within the prison, until a couple imprisoned German officer inmates made a complaint. And then, you know, he got the gag order by the British camp commander. Now during this time, it's interesting because under the provisional government, there was a lot of pressure being put on it to release Trotsky. And the Russian foreign minister at the time, this guy named Pavel Milyukov, he was sort of compelled by these popular demands to directly petition the British government. And Trotsky was freed in April, like late April 1917. So he got to Russia by May, so almost a month further on his journey. So at this point, Trotsky has sided with Lenin in terms of breaking with the Second International and forming a third. He's pretty much in line with
one of Trotsky's favorite things to do, start internationals.
Loves it. Yeah. So he's basically in agreement with nearly every Bolshevik position. But when he gets to Russia, he still doesn't join them. Like, he opts instead to join another minor faction. I'm going to butcher this pronunciation too. It's like the Mezhuranatsi.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Wait, what's that? Nazi? Just kidding.
Yeah. I'm probably pronouncing that wrong, but it translates to the inter-district disease. So it was like a small independent faction. Neither Menshevik nor Bolshevik, you know, typical Trotsky stuff, you know, walking that line. He very quickly becomes the leader of this faction and is put back in charge of the St. Petersburg Soviet. Now, a lot of people like to kind of like toot Trotsky's horn here and say, you know, he was really instrumental in getting the St. Peters Soviet like back to its, you know, agitational prime, like all of these strikes and all of the sort of disruptions that were being caused by the Russian proletariat at this time was because Trotsky was there as the like guiding hand. Now other accounts say that the Bolsheviks in St. Petersburg had been, you know, getting busy with the Soviet, like for a while. They had been organizing massive strikes and massive demonstrations before Trotsky even got there. So again, you know, you'll see this a lot where like Trotsky sort of claims that he has like a direct role or a direct impact in something. And then there are other sources, contemporary sources that were there who are kind of like, I guess, you know, like, yeah, he was there. Sure. I remember, but you know,
which is especially ironic given that he would constantly claim or point out that like Stalin was not on the scene during, you know, a lot of the events of the, you know, Russian Revolution, because he was, you know, off doing other things, right?
Trotsky, you'll find out Trotsky had a very low opinion of Stalin from the jump. And you know, you gotta have to question maybe if there was some racial motivation in there as well. I think he referred to having Stalin as having like Mongolian sort of mysticism or something like that.
He said some racist shit.
You know, Stalin was a Georgian, right? So it's just like the Orientalism is sort of there. Like he projects a lot of stuff onto him. Like he was a brute, you know, he was dumb. He was just like a thug or something, like a gangster. I mean, to be fair, he was, but if you read Stalin's history as a younger man, he seems to be, by all accounts, a very capable organizer.
Also, like, he read a ton. Like, Stalin was not, like, stupid.
Right? No, not at all. Not at all stupid. And if you've ever actually even read Stalin, like, he's able to sort of, like, explain a lot of really complicated, theoretical concepts in very simple English, you know? Like, more often than not, I think, is a sign of intelligence as opposed to the other way around.
Amen.
Yeah, right? All right. So Trotsky gets arrested in August. So we're leading up to the October Revolution, right? This was also kind of in response to the what they call the Kornilov affair, but that's another thing, not really going to get into it.
Yeah.
So he becomes the official chairman of the Petrograd Soviet in October, and that's when shit kicks off, right? And this is something that'll come into play later, but Trotsky again sides with Lenin against Grigory Zinoviev and Lev Kamenev on the question of staging an armed uprising and seizing power to overthrow the provisional government.
Say what you will about the man, he knew the right time, just as Lenin did.
He did. Yes, he did. And Trotsky deserves a lot of credit in October, because he was one of the guys who figured out that sort of like the key centers in St. Petersburg that they needed to like grab control of were like the rail stations, the power stations, the post office, the radio stations. Like, it was Trotsky's initiative that like led the Bolsheviks to adopting that strategy of taking all of these sort of key locations and then basically being able to sort of assert Soviet power in the industrial centers of Russia at the time. So like, you know, props where props is due. Even Stalin had to acknowledge that, who he wrote in Pravda in 1918, that all practical work in connection with the organization of the uprising was done under the immediate direction of Comrade Trotsky, the president of the Petrograd Soviet. It can be stated with certainty that the party is indebted primarily and principally to Comrade Trotsky for the rapid going over of the garrison to the side of the Soviet and the efficient manner in which the work of the Military Revolutionary Committee was organized. So, like, you know, he did it. And, like, was essential in also sort of like quashing some of the counterattacks, right? In November, he led a counterattack against the Cossacks and some other like white Russian forces that were still like kind of lingering around.
He becomes like a very important general during the Civil War.
Yeah. Yeah. He's like I forget the fucking original title. It's like he's like one of the People's Commissars of the Red Army. Head of the Red Army.
Yeah, he like pretty much organized it.
Yeah, yeah. Right. And that was, again, that's part of his whole sort of like theoretical contribution, right? Well, he really felt that the army of a socialist revolution should be pulled from the ranks of the proletariat, and that's more or less exactly what he did.
It's funny, right? Because a lot of times, like in retrospect and largely in the West, there is this vision of Trotsky as like, I don't know, a more conscious form of like, I guess, communism. Mm-hmm. But like Trotsky was almost first and foremost like into like war communism by necessity, to be fair. But like that was like his thing, like Red Army Napoleonic shit.
Yeah, like Army of the Proletariat. Like that was his whole thing. War communism, as it later became known. Like he advocated for that system, probably well past its prime. Like, you know, when we get into like talking about the new economic policy of Lenin, you know, he was against it. He wanted to expand war communism even further.
Yeah. Real quick, Chet. Sorry, real quick. I did have a short thing on just the events of the October Revolution.
Oh, cool.
It's mostly just an anecdote. So in the course of researching, you know, Trotsky, I found out that, well, you know, that journalist, John Reed, the guy who wrote 10 Days That Shook the World. Mm-hmm. Turns out the dude was a spy.
No shit. Who would have thunk?
For the United States, right?
Yeah.
Which, for my money, like, you ever see that movie Reds?
Yeah, I was just going to say, is that the dude that Reds is based off of?
Yeah, I forget if, like, it's Warren Beatty or something.
It is. It's Warren Beatty.
So, like, I always thought that it was, like, bizarre, because that movie came out in, like, the 80s. Like, and I was just like, how did Hollywood ever turn out a movie like that? And it's like, well, yeah, because John Reed was a spy.
Yeah.
It's just that, like, you know, the Cold War hadn't started yet. But, oh, and then also it's notable because early intelligence reports from the United States during the October Revolution tended to heavily favor Leon Trotsky, which is telling. Mm-hmm. And related to that, Trotsky would later name John Reed the Soviet consul in New York.
Huh.
And they had sort of a closer relationship. Like, for like John Reed and all of those guys, they were all a lot closer to Trotsky than anyone else. And this is well before any, you know, split, right?
Wow.
And then one other final note is just that in 1918, there would be three major plots to assassinate Lenin. Lenin would be shot in one of them. And it's notable to note that Sidney Reilly would be heavily involved in one of the plots, which, of course, Sidney Reilly was connected to Trotsky, right? Yeah. And if Lenin were to get caught at that juncture, who would have been the man, right?
Yeah, he would have been the man. Damn, I did not know that. That's crazy.
Right?
Yeah. Shit. All right. You got any more?
No, that's it.
Okay, so the next big, I guess, career move for Trotsky was he became the People's Commissar of Foreign Affairs. And this basically put him in charge of negotiating the separate peace with the German government so that the newly formed Soviet Union could exit World War I. Now, famously, this is another sort of schism with Lenin, right? Because Lenin was just like, We can't beat the Germans. Like, we just barely like got a hold of this shit. There's still plenty of peasants and like loyalists in the countryside that want to like.
The country is like starving.
Yeah, exactly. So he's like, we got to secure this peace at any cost. And there was a couple territorial concessions in there that like Trotsky wasn't stoked about. But really, the primary driver for Trotsky here was the, I guess you'd say, the zeal of the idea of permanent revolution, right? He very much thought that the newly formed Red Army could just roll across the border into Poland and then into Germany. And, you know, the workers of those countries would just hop up and join them.
Like very almost consciously like Napoleon shit.
Yeah, in a lot of ways. Yeah. And like Trotsky, I don't know if he ever compared himself to Napoleon, but he was definitely well read on Napoleonic history because he constantly used terms from that era and like the French Revolution as an analogy for things that were happening in Russia. Like he famously would compare Stalin to like a Napoleonic type, like a Bonapartist or whatever.
Which it's like, okay, like that's like probably bad strategy to compare your political opponent to Napoleon, because like to anyone but the British, that is a cool thing to be.
I know, right? And like I also gotta believe that like it only became a negative for him when it wasn't him. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Like once he realized that he wasn't going to be the one like leading the armies of the proletariat across Europe, then it became a problem.
Yeah.
So by all accounts, Trotsky was trying to sabotage these negotiations. And there's actually, I think you mentioned him, the Russian Blumkin?
Yeah, Blumkin.
Who was an early associate of Trotsky's and was assassinated a German ambassador, also in an attempt to sort of delay these peace talks from happening.
Yeah, I was actually, like, I think I had notes here. Let me see if I wrote down much about Blumkin. Crap. I think I did have something. Yeah, so I think Blumkin was ostensibly a left SR, social revolutionary.
Yeah.
But I think he it was a German diplomat that the left SRs assassinated in July of 1918. And the left SRs explicitly wanted to restart World War One, basically. And it's just like first of all, it was insane. Because that would have been disastrous for Russia, but also just like that was reason why the Bolsheviks would later like suppress the left SRs basically.
Yeah.
And then Blumkin later on would be caught and executed. And supposedly right before, this is like many decades later.
Right.
Supposedly Blumkin would shout "Long live Trotsky" before being shot.
Yeah. And I think, that was in like 1929 too, or maybe even like 1930. So it's like really early in terms of like Trotsky's like exile activity. So he was like, he was one of the, Blumkin was also one of the first Soviets to meet with Trotsky on the first stop of his post-Soviet Union exile in Turkey. So he, you know, this guy was like with him from the jump, which makes me question considering that, you know, one of Trotsky's motivations here was to delay this peace talk until the Red Army could, you know, sort of muster up the strength to lead to the creation of the pan-European Soviet. But, you know, that wasn't happening. And I got to wonder, like, was Blumkin taking instructions from Trotsky as early as 1918? I don't know, man.
Right. It's like, was he trying to whack Lenin? Was he trying to like restart World War One?
You'll see this happening like too a lot. Like they'll like as we get into the conspiracy, right? Like there'll be people who will be like, yeah, actually I was recruited by Trotsky in like 1923, you know, and like was instructed to keep quiet about it until like the perfect moment. So like, yeah, it wouldn't surprise me at all, like if Blumkin was taking some of his instructions from that.
Yeah, I was going to say too, I don't have the notes for this, but, and I think I was telling you, but I neglected to look it up. But like, there's this interesting story when they're like sitting down to negotiate the separate peace and Trotsky, you know, doesn't really want to. And there's this story of him trying to like debate the German diplomat and general, like the generals who are like there to negotiate. And he's just like, trying to argue with them about like Marxism, and they're just like, shut the fuck up, like we're not here to talk about that.
Yeah, that sounds like a Trotsky move for sure. I think there was, even pre-revolution, there was this famous instance where like Trotsky had, or maybe it was post-revolution, either way there's a lot of these, but he had like a he wanted to basically plead his case for adopting a particular line or something like that. And the Central Committee was like, all right, you got an hour. And he insisted on giving the same speech in both German and Russian and French, I think. So like it ended up going on for like 3 to 4 hours.
Imagine doing it in French. What the hell?
I know. Like, what would even be the point? But I mean, you know, just to prove that he could speak it, you know.
He's just out here flexing.
Yeah, just showing off his bona fides as a polylingual person or whatever. I don't know. But yeah, so eventually they do decide, you know, the Brest-Litovsk piece has to be signed, and they sign it, right?
And like, to be clear, like, there were territorial concessions, but like, yes, they also had to give up like a shit ton of gold. Like,
yeah. Yeah,
I get into that a little bit later, but like, this was like a essentially making Russia take a huge L.
Yep. Yeah. It was a pretty big L. Trotsky and his supporters in the committee abstained from this vote too. So like, they were dragging their feet right up to the final moment. But eventually the proposal was passed, and they accepted it.
Which, like, they had to.
They absolutely had to.
Their whole thing was, like, land, peace, bread. And if they couldn't provide bread, and they couldn't provide peace, and they couldn't even really provide land, then what the fuck was the point of the revolution?
Yeah, yeah. They had the calm shit down, for sure. And it was probably a good thing that they did, because more or less immediately, like, I think they had maybe like the late winter and spring to sort of cool off, but by the summer, early summer of 1918, the Russian Civil War was basically in like full effect,
pretty much like right off the jump.
Yeah, like right off the jump. And Trotsky, this is when he gets, I think, elevated to like the proper sort of like head of the Red Army. And yeah, grind war communism into full effect. He's introducing the system of political commissars, which, you know, credit where credit's due. It's probably a good move, right? If you want your army to remain ideologically coherent and cohesive, probably that good keeps... to have political officers attached to all your units.
Yeah, because like, you can't just like throw out anyone who would have like ties to the old regime, because that's literally everyone who knows how to do anything.
Right.
So, right. Like,
right. So Trotsky, and this is, there's so much interesting stuff that was happening in the Russian Civil War. We got to be very careful not to go off on tangents here.
Exactly. But
one thing that is, I think, important to sort of emphasize, right? Like, Trotsky during the Russian Civil War was, if anything, as brutal or more than any of the than like all the crimes that he would later accuse Stalin of, right? Like, he brutally suppressed the Kronstadt rebellion. And like, when he got down to dealing with the peasants in Ukraine and like some of the green movement and like Nestor Marco's like anarchist sort of bandits or whatever, I mean, I know that's gonna piss off some anarchists, like,
it's listen, fine by me, man.
They were more or less bandits. I don't know what else you want to say. But I mean, like, cool, they were cool. It's like living in a like a pirate republic or something like that. Sure. I mean, if that's your bag, that's your bag.
Mad Max style.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, there I remember reading one thing about Nestor Marco where he had like these sort of like wagon tanks that he used to like drag behind.
It's funny, Chad, I actually still have a shirt for that like Ukrainian flag that the Makhno people had, and I bought it back when I thought that was super badass, and now I'm like like, no, they should have put those people down. And it's like, I still have the shirt, I still think it's cool.
yeah I mean, and you know, anarchists got they got that punk aesthetic early like early in the go. And I remember also, as going through the course of this research, coming across like memes and stuff. And I remember seeing one that was like Stalin and Nestor Marco, and then like anti Trotsky action, like fuck it, one struggle. Like, that's pretty funny. But yeah, so like, the Trotsky goes through the Russian Civil War, and I'm again pretty effective, right? Like,
oh yeah.
Yeah, like, definitely brutal, like, definitely had no qualms about just completely liquidating his opposition.
Like, there were points at which they were basically taking grain at gunpoint, for sure.
Yes, yeah.
But it's like, that was, like, to keep all of Russia from not starving, on the other hand, so.
Yeah, and that itself is like, that's like the essence of war communism as a doctrine, right? It's mm-hmm. just like the like forced collectivization at sort of like the micro level, right? Like if they need it, they're going to expropriate it from the population because it's for the good of the worker state, right? Definitely necessary, probably, to keep, you know, a state in its infancy, like alive during a situation like the Russian Civil War, where not only do you have, like, you know, the white Russians, you know, which were like the pro-czarist forces, but you also had anarchists, peasant rebellions, and like armies from, I think, what, like 17 Western countries, like expeditionary forces.
The expeditionary forces. Mm-hmm. Also a separate army from Japan.
Yes. Yeah. And then you got all kinds of other weird shit, like the Czechoslovakian Legion, which was like trapped behind the borders of Russia, like after the, like when the revolution happened, and then went on this like crazy journey all the way to Siberia in order to get out. Some of them sort of like dropping out and becoming like weird little like quasi-Buddhist warlords like along the way.
Oh yeah, some of those White Army generals were just like literally just like Colonel Kurtz in Apocalypse Now shit.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. So October 19, 1919, in October, this is like when Denikin, who was a big white Russian guy, was kind of making his biggest advance, right? And this is also in a situation where like you'll see Trotsky supporting actually like Stalin and Zinoviev against Lenin and how to deal with that. And I only mention that only because as we go further on, you're going to see a lot of, I guess, what we'd call like flip-flopping, you know, like the sort of alignments of who's in, you know, who's working with who switch a lot, as well as the positions tend to like kind of switch a lot. It's kind of important to note.
Solidarity.